Investors Chronicle.
Hello and welcome back to the IC Interviews. I'm Dave Baxter and joining me today is Craig Baker, Global Chief Investment Officer at Willis Towers Watson, who also chairs the Investment Committee for Alliance Trust. For those who don't know it, Alliance Trust is one of the biggest global equity investment trusts out there for UK investors and takes quite an interesting multi-manager approach where it effectively delegates its investments to a selection of professional stock pickers running their own concentrated portfolio, and it aims to outperform the MSCI All Country World Index by 2% a year after costs over a rolling three-year period. So, Craig, thanks for joining us. How are you doing?
I'm very good, thanks. Pleasure to be here.
Good to hear. So, Alliance Trust has been an interesting one to watch in the last year or two. I suppose, like some of the other kind of big global equity names, if you look back a few years, it had a bit of a kind of tough time trying to keep up with the kind of global index, trying to keep up with that big rush of the big US stocks and so on. But it has been holding up a bit better both last year and kind of this year as well, which perhaps might seem surprising given market conditions. Maybe to kick off, what has been kind of driving the performance of the trust versus the index in recent times?
Yeah, so relative to the index, as you say, we perform well in both 2022 and so far in 2023, which have been very different environments. And I think what that shows is that it's really stock selection that's driving everything. So we're not running big macro positions, so we don't have big country bets, we don't have big industry bets. It really is driven from the bottom up through stock selection, and we actually design it that way. We pick managers that think about the world very differently, so that when you combine them, they're not taking an overall style bet. They really are having stock selection come through. And that's exactly what's been happening this time. As you say, there was a period where it was very concentrated in a small number of stocks back in 2018, 19, 20. And that was a tough time for active management if you weren't overweight those two or three stocks. In particular, it was Apple and Tesla that were driving those markets. We had nothing in both of those stocks. And that was tough, although even in that period, we managed to just about keep up with the strong performance from the index itself. What you've seen in 2023 is that, yes, there are seven stocks that have driven the market. They're being referred to as the Magnificent Seven, very large US growth stocks, technology stocks in particular. We've actually been slightly underweight that seven as a group over the whole period. We're pretty neutral at the moment overall, but we've still had that very significant underweight Apple and Tesla, for example. But now it hasn't just been those stocks that have been driving it. We've actually had very strong performance from being overweight Alphabet, Microsoft, Amazon, for example. And so we haven't really had that as a big headwind. It hasn't been a positive for us in relative terms, but it hasn't been a big negative because we haven't been significantly underweight the whole seven. And so it's really been good stock selection from the rest of the portfolio that's come through in both 2022 and 2023. And I think that's because you've started to see fundamentals really have more of an impact on stock prices outside of those small number of stocks we've just talked about. And that probably wasn't the case if you go back a few years ago, where perhaps there was more retail flows that were driving performance and fundamentals weren't really coming through. There were a number of stocks that the companies were beating earnings expectations in the market quite significantly, but still getting hit in stock price terms. That started to change. I wouldn't say it's fully come through in markets, and we actually think, therefore, there's a lot to come in terms of outperformance from here in the portfolio. But that's certainly come through in 2022 and 2023's numbers.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see if we see more of that kind of market dispersion come through. Perhaps people would attribute that to, you know, factors like kind of rising interest rates and more kind of creative destruction and so on. I suppose what interests me about the portfolio is, of course, as you mentioned, there's a very pure focus on stock picking, and you have these kind of different I suppose, almost best ideas portfolios, and then that kind of creates an overall fund. But as you mentioned, some of the kind of big prominent market leaders are still pretty present in Alliance Trusts. So, you know, Alphabet and Microsoft, both pretty big holdings. I suppose it'll be interesting to see whether that kind of dominance of those stocks can be kind of challenged as we see that dispersion. I don't know whether you're kind of hearing any of that from your kind of favoured stock pickers and, you know, what they're kind of expecting.
Yeah, it's kind of quite a mix. So a number of them are absolutely thinking that this is just inevitable reversal. We look over pretty much any of the periods in the past where the index has become quite concentrated in a small number of companies. You then look at the sort of following 10-year performance, and actually they've tended to lag quite significantly the rest of the market, because you do get these regimes, then they change, and it will be different leaders that come through over the next period. So there's certainly a number of the managers thinking that. I think the interesting bit is AI in all of this, and how much of an impact that's going to have. Because if you actually look at some of those Magnificent Seven, that's very much been a feature of 2023, is that, you know, almost any company that comes out and talks about AI as part of their approach has had a bit of a boon in its stock price. I think, you know, genuinely with a few of those Magnificent Seven companies, there's some pretty good arguments that the fundamentals really are there. These are not like some of the growth stocks we've seen in the past that have been bid up, haven't really got any earnings, and it's all about future growth expectations from zero. These are good companies that are actually producing strong cash flows and earnings. So it's not quite the same as we've seen in some other periods. So we've got a bit of a mix amongst the managers, which is why we've ended up on average over the last year or so only being slightly underweight those seven as a total, but we've certainly got some of the managers in the lineup that have got nothing in those companies, and of course they're the ones that have done particularly well in 2022, struggled a bit more in 2023.
And are you tending to maybe you've mentioned to me before, with you have your kind of balance of different styles, and you normally have tried to almost kind of like top up the losers and kind of take profits on the winners. Is that still the process kind of going forward?
It is. Yeah, that's absolutely the principle we start with. You know, why wouldn't we be rebalancing is why we is where we start with the question. Now, it may be that there's good reasons that you're not going to do that at a particular point in time, and that's thinking about the mix and the impact it has on the overall portfolio. And so you're also looking at, well, what does it do to my style exposure? What does it do to my small cap versus large cap exposure? Is it going to lead us to have unintended sector and country bets if we move around the weightings in the managers, or if we're adding a new manager as we have done recently? What impact does that have? So all of those things come into the mix. But as a general principle, yes, we would be looking to, on average, be taking some capital away from the ones that have done particularly well, where it's been driven by their style. If it's just been driven purely by their stock selection, you're less quick to make that change. But even then, you know, ultimately, some of those could well reverse. And so that's a general principle, is adding to those that have had a tougher time because of their style, and taking away from those that have had their style in favour for a period of time.
Has there been, have you found there's been almost a muddying of the water in terms of style and what your manager's doing? So, for example, I think of last year, the big tech stocks were getting absolutely battered. You know, Facebook or Meta was, I think, down something like 60% for the year and in the end. And you began to see some kind of well-known, you know, global value funds holding what people have always viewed, or for a long time has viewed, as almost quintessential growth stocks. How has that kind of played out within your kind of selected managers and your portfolio?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's very easy to talk about value and growth as being completely different things. But I mean, of course, every manager's looking for something that's good value and will grow. And so, you know, it's not as simple as black or white. And certainly that's the way we go about constructing the portfolio. We don't look for, you know, we need to fill a bucket of large cap growth. Now we need to fill a bucket of small cap value. Now, instead, we look at who are the best stock pickers out there in our opinion, and let's pick a variety of them that think about the world very differently. Mm. So even within the value space and the growth space, they're very different. So you gave an example there. If we take a couple of our value managers, you've got someone like a Lyrical who will be looking for the absolute cheapest companies in the world, and then deciding which of those are going to do well. That the market's hit the share price in terms of thinking that something's going on in the company when actually it's not as bad as the market thinks, and there's good reasons why that company can continue to do well. And then you've equally got someone like Vulcan Value that's in the portfolio that will call themselves a value manager, but their starting point is what are some of the great companies that are out there, and then which ones look very, very cheap. Mm. So those two managers will almost never have the same stock in their portfolio, but they're both value managers, but they're coming at it quite differently. And so Vulcan's actually done very well. In fact, it's probably the best performing manager we've got over 2023, because they've actually got a number of companies that people might look at and say are quite growthy in nature, but actually their view was that they were well below their intrinsic value, whereas Lyrical's underperformed in 2023, did well in 2022, but has underperformed in 2023 because they've got a very different starting point within that value universe.
And kind of sticking on that theme, what would, as you say, the kind of the different managers you back at, they're quite disparate, take different approaches, but what to you defines a kind of a good stock picker? And I suppose a question that's very relevant to our listeners, given active management can sometimes have quite a spotty record, you know, what makes you stick with a manager and what makes you finally kind of quit a manager if they've been struggling?
Yeah. So, I mean, ultimately, what we're trying to find in this portfolio is genuine stock pickers that have got quite a long-term time horizon, and they think about risk more in terms of permanent loss of capital in the companies that they're investing in rather than risk relative to a benchmark or relative to the peer group. We can worry about what the overall portfolio looks like relative to the benchmark and manage risk in terms of the weightings we put to the various stock pickers, and we can pick stock pickers that think differently and solve it that way. We don't want them to be thinking about that. We want them to have quite a long-term time horizon. And so that is relevant to both parts of your question. So firstly, we're looking for people that have got a track record of being able to take long-term views on stocks, hold on when things aren't going their way in share price terms if they're still confident in the fundamentals of the company, and have got a track record of doing that through different market cycles. And so that's essentially what we're looking for. Often it's individuals that have worked in the industry for a number of years, maybe worked at some large organisations, really learnt their trade through different environments from some high-quality investors of the past, and then maybe over time have ended up starting their own shop, their own boutique asset management firm, and they can run assets exactly the way they want to. They can control their own destiny in terms of not having to grow the business too large, have their own investment alongside those of clients, and have alignment of interest that way. Often, if you look through the portfolio, those are the kinds of organisations we've got in here, and kinds of individuals that we've got in here. What it also means to your second part of your question, you know, if we're looking for people that think long term, we need to think long term in terms of how we're evaluating them. And so when we're looking at the performance of a manager, what we're really trying to do is dig down into what are the component parts of that performance, what's actually driven how they've done relative to the benchmark. We don't mind if they've underperformed, if you would have expected them to underperform with their style and approach over that period. And so what we try and do is break out how much has come from the stock picker's ability to call the fundamentals in the companies versus how much just happens to have come from what's happened to the price earnings multiple, for example, on that company, because the market as a whole is suddenly liking one area of the market and all price earnings multiples have increased, and suddenly disliking some other areas of the market and they've all contracted. So we actually split out how much of that's come from that. So if we find a manager that's actually been calling the fundamentals correctly. They've been investing in some companies that have been surprising on the upside with their earnings, but that just hasn't come through in the share price yet, and hence they've lagged the market. We'd be adding money to those managers because their style's been out of favour. Whereas clearly you could have a manager that's outperformed, but actually, in our opinion, they've actually been calling the fundamentals wrongly in some of the managers. They've got lucky because there's just been multiple expansion. Anyone in their area of the market would have done well. We might actually be concerned about that manager. And so it's not always just whether they've outperformed or underperformed. It's what's driven that outperformance or underperformance. And the other thing is, has anything changed in the proposition of what we bought the manager for in the first place? And so the most likely things that make us want to take a manager out will be something like the key individuals left, or they've started to grow the assets too large that they can't actually add the kind of value that they used to in the past, or there's been a change in ownership and we're concerned about the culture of the organisation going forward. Those kind of things are more likely to make us change a manager rather than just short or medium term performance.
And are there any red flags that would point to, I suppose, the risk of so-called style drift? So this is something we think about a lot. If you have I suppose in recent years, it's tended to be a topic of most relevance to value managers when value was very out of favour. There was a worry that a value manager would kind of drift into, you know, growth investing in order to try and shore up their bad performance. And then finally, when value does come good, they're not really in the right position to take advantage.
Yeah, it's a great question. This is what we spend a lot of our time on. It's a really important part of it, particularly with a multi-manager approach like this, because what we don't want is them all to start moving towards whatever the style is that's been doing well recently, because then the whole idea of having a style-neutral portfolio goes out the window. And so we spend a lot of time on this. It's actually quite difficult because of your question earlier around, well, everyone's a bit value and bit growth, and there'll be times where you end up in stocks that maybe look a little bit growth when you're a value manager and vice versa. So it is a tough thing to do. And ultimately, that comes down to a lot of qualitative research that we do into these managers. So we'll be spending time with them on a very regular basis, going through the stocks in the portfolio, trying to understand why they invest in them. And just as importantly, why they haven't, for example, taken profits on stocks that have done well. But your example's a good one in that a lot of value managers just had a number of years of underperformance and capitulated to a certain extent and just couldn't continue to run that business risk. And so that's exactly the sort of thing we're trying to keep an eye on and see whether there is a drift in that. It comes through quite easily in ours because we start to see if the overall portfolio starts to have a style bias, because normally it's pretty style neutral. And if we're continually having to change weightings because more and more managers are drifting towards the same style, it becomes fairly obvious to us in the Alliance Trust portfolio.
Yeah. And looking, I suppose, at the portfolio itself, you know, we've mentioned some of those kind of big US names that are prominent in the portfolio, which may seem it kind of may make it look in line with the broader market. But what are the kind of interesting calls currently within the portfolio that perhaps make it stand out from, if I was simply to buy an MSCI World Tracker or so on?
Yeah, so one of the measures that people often use about how different an active portfolio is to the benchmark is a term called active money, where it actually looks at from a score of 0 to 100, 0 means you're exactly in line with the index, so you've got no active money. 100 means you've got nothing, you don't own any of the stocks that are actually in the index, so you look nothing like it. Most portfolios might be in the 50, 60% type thing. You might have some punchy single manager portfolios that are up in the 70, 80% type numbers. Most multi-manager portfolios, much lower. Because we run these concentrated portfolios, our active money is actually quite high, close to 80%, even with a multi-manager approach. So actually, it's very different from the benchmark. But of course, as you say, if you look at the list of top 10 positions, it's got some of the largest stocks in there. If we take the most active positions, the biggest active position is that we've got almost nothing in Apple, and Apple makes up more than 4 or 5% of the benchmark. And yes, we've got Alphabet as an overweight, but other big overweights we've got are Visa, MasterCard, United Health Group, Petrobras, Amazon we've mentioned, but Airbus, HDFC Bank in India, and a few others like Mercado Libre. So there are some different names just in the top 10. But I think the interesting thing about the way Alliance Trust is designed is that it is not all about the top 10 stocks. They make up a smaller proportion of our portfolio than maybe many others. It's actually quite a diversified portfolio because you're asking these stock pickers to pick their very best 20 ideas anywhere. They're not typically just going to be the largest 20 stocks. And there's actually quite limited overlap between what the managers are owning. Clearly in things like Alphabet and Amazon, we have got a number of the managers owning them, and that's why they end up being in the largest overweight. But for the vast majority of stocks in the portfolio, only one portfolio manager owns them. And so there's some quite interesting names in there that wouldn't be found in a lot of active portfolios that are out there, and hence why we've been able to significantly outperform the peer group over most of the periods over the last few years.
And as you mentioned, I suppose the underweight to Apple is quite an interesting, you know, you're taking a view by not taking a position. What do you hear from your stock pickers on, you know, that kind of thesis? Why are they not kind of being drawn to that like many other investors are?
Yeah, it's an interesting one because, you know, unlike if you ask a typical single manager to run against a benchmark and think about risk relative to that benchmark, they have to spend a lot of time thinking about their underweight position to something as large as Apple. Because we ask each of the managers to think more in terms of permanent loss of capital rather than that risk relative to benchmark and just pick their 20 best ideas, they're not actually sitting there saying they're particularly negative on Apple. In fact, most of them would say it's a good company and they're reasonably positive about it, but it just wouldn't be in their top 20 ideas. And most of that's just purely down to the fact that it's had such a strong run performance-wise that they don't see that as the most obvious winner over the next 5+ years, given that it's been such a winner over the last decade plus. And so it's more that on Apple in particular. They're not having a negative view per se, but of course it does come out that way. That's about the only stock that's large enough that's the case in the portfolio. As I said, Tesla's the next biggest underweight. And whereas it's a 4% underweight in Apple, it's only a 1% underweight in Tesla because Tesla's only, 1.2% of the index.
Yeah. And I suppose speaking again about kind of market concentration and that kind of thing, it's interesting that the trust is, you know, technically kind of underweight to North America, but you still have a big weighting in America like many global portfolios. Do you get any sense from your stock pickers that kind of US dominance will end? You know, people always argue that the US is just so hard to beat in terms of building world-leading companies and so on.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the ones that are running a truly global portfolio, on average, they're quite significantly underweight the US and have been for virtually the whole period we've been running the trust. That's around 6.5, getting on for 7 years now. And what we actually did is we didn't want that to be the dominant risk factor in the portfolio. And so we've got a couple of managers in there that focus more on the US than they do globally. And so that includes Vulcan and that includes Lyrical, who are in the portfolio and primarily invest in US. They can invest elsewhere, but they primarily invest in the US. That's their real skill set. And part of the reason for having them in there was to ensure that we didn't run too big a position. Now, thankfully, that has been beneficial because the US has continued to do incredibly well, despite people thinking that that market was looking less attractive than some of the others on valuation grounds. Now, a lot of that's driven by the fact that it's been a small number of tech companies that have driven the rally. If you actually take those out of it, US has done less well on a relative basis than it looks when you include those. So that's been a good risk control for us. But as you say, we're still underweight the US. And so if you do see a change in the leadership from a geographical perspective, we would actually benefit from that. But it is risk managed so that stock selection is still the primary driver through everything.
And looking beyond the US, what kind of regions might, you know, stand out now or in the future?
Yes, an interesting one, because we don't typically take big macro views, as I've said. However, one area that we think looks particularly interesting, in particular from an alpha generation, so a stock selection perspective, is Japan. Clearly, it's a market that's underperformed for quite a long time, has had a bit of a resurgence in recent times, but still nothing compared to the long period of relative underperformance. It still looks cheap on most grounds that you could look at, both relative to its own history and relative to other markets. But that in itself's not an interesting point. That's been true for a while. The particularly interesting thing is what's changing in terms of the dynamics within that market. And so previous Prime Minister Abe made a number of structural reforms to make it a bit more shareholder friendly. And then in January this year, a new rule came in that companies that are at a price to book value below one have to set out what their plans are to get it above one. And so you're starting to see quite a change in the mindset within that universe around companies thinking about what they do with some of these stockpiles of cash that they've got, and that might lead to share buybacks, that might lead to further investment in the business, and actually you're seeing quite a lot of shareholder activism coming to the fore in that market to try and encourage some of these companies to do these things. And so what we've actually done in July was put in a new manager, which is Dalton. And that's a manager we've been following for a long time. They were set up in 1999 and very much have got skills in Asia and Japan in particular. And their 20-stock portfolio that they're now running for us is going to be focused on Japan, a bit more in the mid and small cap space, but really trying to take advantage of exactly what I've just talked about and looking for companies where they think the management is aligned to shareholder interests and is going to start working on some of these things, picking what they think are particularly undervalued companies that can benefit from the use of cash on the balance sheet or whatever it might be to be a bit more shareholder friendly and drive returns. When you then add that to the fact that the market as a whole looks pretty cheap and they're in a different environment in terms of inflation and interest rates than the rest of the world, it actually looks a pretty attractive proposition from our perspective.
Interesting. And turning to, I suppose, some of the kind of other elements of the trust world, there's been, I suppose, a few interesting developments from Alliance Trust in the last year or two. One is, I suppose, like many other trusts, there's been a bit of ramping up in terms of kind of buyback activity. The trust is kind of, I suppose, attributed the stability, relative stability of the share price discount to that in part. Is there kind of a rough ruling on that front? I mean, it's an interesting balancing act. You know, what is more value? Is it kind of buying back your shares, or is it better for the trust to be, you know, pouring that money into the underlying investments?
Yes. So you're right. I mean, the whole global equity investment trust sector has seen discounts widen in recent times. And I think the average for the global equity investment trust sector is about minus 14% now, so a 14% discount to NAV. The board on Alliance Trust have followed a discount management policy such that they want to try and keep it stable. They think that's in the interests of investors to have a relatively stable discount or premium to NAV. They've been able to do that from two parts. The first is, you know, just the fact that there's quite a lot of interest in the trust at the moment, and so we're seeing less of that blowout of the discount than a lot of the others because we've been outperforming the peer group by quite some way in recent times. So that's a good part of it. And then part of it has been continuing to do buybacks as appropriate in order to ensure that it does stay at a sensible discount. And it's pretty much stayed around 6% for quite a few years now on the discount side of things, whereas, as I say, the sector has gone out to about 14% discount. So that's quite a big difference to others. the board see that as a positive for shareholders? I mean, ultimately, that's accretion in the NAV. You're buying at a discount, and that actually improves performance, and it also gives stability to investors as well, which is helpful in managing their own portfolios.
Yeah. But again, an interesting, I suppose, opportunity cost. I was quite enjoying some comments from the chairman of the Invesco Asia Trust recently, talking about why they hadn't done buybacks. And he was talking about there were some great long-term investment opportunities on the horizon. And he said something like, we do not want to stand in the way of that. Another, I suppose, interesting development has been on the kind of dividend front. You know, you have seen some big dividend increases from the trust in its recent history. In part, I think, using kind of revenue reserves that had built up over time. Should we kind of be expecting to see more of that trajectory? And, you know, what effect does that kind of have when it comes to the actual investment portfolio? You know, do your stock pickers need to focus more on natural income? Does yield begin to play more of a part in the portfolio?
Yeah, it's always a balance, isn't it? I mean, the ultimate objective for the trust is to be a core investment that delivers a real return over the long term through a combination of capital growth and a rising dividend. So it is looking for a rising dividend, the trust is a dividend hero. It's now increased its dividend 56 years in a row. And of all the AIC dividend heroes out there, it's actually had the highest five-year growth in dividends. So it's now sitting at a pretty attractive dividend yield relative to a number of others in the global equity sector. But it's not an income fund per se. This is just trying to give a balance of good returns from capital growth, but also a rising dividend. And that's something that will continue. There was a big reset last year with a very significant increase in the dividend to make sure the yield was at a position that the board thought was appropriate. And the board talked to a number of the investors in the trust to check what would work for them. And so have come to that balance of where they think's the right spot. So, yes, I would expect to continue to see rising dividends after 56 years. It's unlikely that we're going to want to be stopping that now. The big advantage of Alliance Trust relative to most is just the huge set of revenue reserves and wider reserves that the trust has got. And so it is able to do that for a number of years, almost regardless of what's happening in the markets at the particular point in time. As it happened, the dividend was covered in 2022 by the yield on the portfolio. But, you know, if there are years where that's not the case, they can continue to smooth that out through the use of the reserves as appropriate.
Is that yield something you guys think about much? I mean, I think I've recently looked and it was around 2.3%, which, as you say, is not bad for a global fund, though. Of course, you can find bigger yields elsewhere.
Yep.
UK equities, alternatives, even bonds now, which is quite a change. But is that kind of, what kind of focus is that?
So in terms of how we manage the portfolio, it doesn't really affect us too much. We've been able to cover the dividend in most of the recent years with the natural yield on the portfolio. So we certainly don't set any of the stock pickers limits on what they have to do. They don't have a minimum yield they have to achieve or anything like that. Of course, you know, by its nature of us picking managers that think about the world differently, some of them actually, as part of their natural process, have dividend yield as an important part of what they're looking for in the stocks that they're investing in. Others don't. And that's quite a big mix between the managers. But as a result, you tend to end up with a natural yield on the portfolio that doesn't look wildly different from that of the index. Now, if we ever needed to, we could add more income-oriented type managers to the portfolio. That's one of the advantages of the multi-manager approach. You don't have to suddenly ask managers that don't think that way to have that as part of their process suddenly. Mm-hmm. You could just add other managers that do. But that's not something we need to worry about in the short to medium term. The natural yield on the portfolio is absolutely fine, particularly when you allow for the reserves that are in place as well.
And speaking of kind of the approach, and I suppose the approach can evolve over time. If you look at some of kind of Alliance Trust's big rivals, I suppose one interesting difference that springs out to me is the fact that some of them do delve slightly beyond just the equity space. They may kind of, you know, look at private equity trusts and that kind of thing. Is that ever something that would be a consideration for you guys, or is it always the aim to be kind of the base equity exposure and then leave those elements elsewhere?
So when we took over the trust back in 2017, one of the things that the board had done at that time was to do a full strategic review of what they wanted the trust to be. And at the time, that it had a number of things outside traditional public equities. That included private equity, that included some mineral rights, that included some real estate and a few other things, and also included Alliance Trust Savings as part of the overall portfolio. At that time, they took the view that they wanted to move back to the roots of being a pure public equity investment trust, and that's how we've been managing it since that. You know, it took a couple of years to wind down some of those positions, but certainly over the last 3 years or so, it's been a fully invested equity, public equity portfolio. Now, could the board decide to evolve that through time? Of course, but as it stands today, the remit is to keep that as a public equity portfolio. Of course, that's been beneficial in recent times, and a number of trusts out there are struggling with some of their private markets positions in the portfolio. And of course, that it's all about how you manage those private markets positions. There's nothing inherently wrong in doing that. It has potential advantages, but you know, it can have implications on your portfolio and what that can do to gearing in the portfolio if there if the market's falling and you've got private market positions and they can grow in size in the portfolio. Thankfully, we've not had any of those issues at all over the last few years.
And you mentioned gearing. How is the gearing looking in the portfolio at the minute?
Yeah, so we tend to run, well, we have a strategic position on gearing, gross gearing in the portfolio of 10%. And we typically don't take big positions from that. Again, wanting stock selection to drive things rather than WTW's view on whether equities are going to go up or down. And so we would typically be in the 7.5% to 12.5% range, but can go below 7.5%, particularly if it's markets driving it below that, and can go above 12.5% similarly. But most of the time you'd be in that kind of range. Mm. We're at the bottom end of that as of today. And whilst we're very excited about the portfolio from a bottom-up perspective, you know, we've done a lot of work on what the fundamentals of the companies look like, and we're very excited that hasn't fully come through in share prices yet. And so there's some real potential upside in relative outperformance. We're very excited about it from a bottom-up perspective, as are the underlying stock pickers. We recognise that there are some risks at a top-down level. You've seen rising interest rates, inflation being a bit more sticky than some might like. Certainly bond markets tend to be pricing in more of a recessionary type environment than equity markets are. And so with that level of caution, we're at the lower end of the typical gearing range. But there is still some gearing in the portfolio. As I said, 7.5% on a gross basis. That's more like 4.5%, 5% on a net basis.
And speaking of kind of sentiment, you must, I suppose, always be interested to gauge how your managers are feeling and who's upbeat or who's particularly gloomy. You know, at the minute, you know, where's the kind of bearishness coming from, and which kind of managers are you hearing more excitable noises from?
Well, what's actually interesting at the moment is that, as you say, you normally get, you know, some of the managers being particularly excited about their portfolio and some a bit less so. I still think over the long term they're excited about it, but in the short to medium term a bit more concerned about it. Actually, we're sitting here today and most of the managers, if not all of them, are really excited about their portfolio. And I think that lends to this idea that true fundamentals haven't necessarily come through in share prices yet. And that's true whether you're in the growth space, whether you're in the value space, large cap or small cap. And so each of them can point to a number of companies they've got in their portfolio that are really started to beat expectations from a fundamentals perspective, i.e. their earnings progression has been really very strong, but that hasn't yet come through in share price. In fact, they can often give examples of where the share price has fallen on good news on earnings. And so they're sitting there really quite excited that there's genuine latent value in the portfolio. The difference, of course, is that some of the managers think that overall markets are going to do well from here, and others are a bit more bearish on what overall markets are going to do. But the common trait at the moment is that they're all very excited about the individual 20 stocks that they've got in their portfolio. And I know, you know, it's easy to look at it and go, well, yeah, but everyone always says that of their own portfolio. But actually, you do tend to get normally periods where it's more the value managers that are excited about their portfolio or more the growth managers. At the moment, genuinely, there's interest from both of them.
So those managers who are exposed to some of the stocks that have been really flying this year, we've mentioned tech and so on, have they been resisting the temptation to sort of take those profits?
There aren't really any managers that have, you know, loaded up on all of the Magnificent Seven, if you see what I mean. So, you know, even within that, there's been some, you know, taking some profits on a couple of the stocks and adding a bit more to a couple of the others, even within that. But yes, some of those are those that have got positions in that area are still very confident. You know, we've got a reasonably significant overweight, for example, in Alphabet. A number of the managers would talk about the fact that that hasn't really fully reflected how strong that business is today in its share price. I mean, if you remember, Alphabet actually came off quite a bit back in last year, and has had a good run this year, but still a number of them would look at it and say that's not fully reflecting quite how well that business is doing.
And finally, just turning back to the investment trust space, you know, we've seen what's been interesting is we have begun to see some difficulties, and that has led to boards taking action and a decent amount of kind of consolidation and so on. What does that mean for Alliance Trust? I mean, would Alliance Trust potentially be one to kind of take on some of these trusts and expand even further? Would that be a good thing for the future?
Yeah, a good question. I mean, it's really one for the board rather than us in terms of what that might mean. I mean, the main thing from our perspective is what it's meant is that the peer group's been looked as though it's done better than it really has, because some of the poorer performing trusts have dropped out of the peer group.
Survivorship bias.
Correct. Yeah. So there's more survivorship bias. So we've significantly outperformed the peer group, but if you actually recalculate the peer group to include all the ones that were in there at any particular point in time, we've outperformed by quite a lot more than that, which is interesting. So that's probably the biggest impact it's had on us from WTW perspective in terms of how we're managing the trust. As to whether you know, the fact that Alliance Trust has been one of the best performing of all the trusts and has got less of a discount to NAV than any the other trusts, as to whether that means there are acquisition possibilities, I'll have to leave that one to the board.
We shall wait and see. Well, I'm afraid that is all we have time for, but very interesting discussion. So, Craig, thanks for your time, and thank you to everyone for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.